When I was at uni, I had a big essay due on American imperialism. So, naturally, I found myself spending hours and hours on a blog all about childbirth. I remember thinking it was so much more complicated and intense than I had thought. The tearing, the bleeding, the months of recovery that often include wearing a pad all the time. So I called my mum. As the phone rang, I was thinking, dear Lord, there's no way I was worth this. I asked my mum if she'd experienced any of the things I was reading about and if they were common. Mum said, yep. This whole time, I'd had no idea. Our mums have heaps of strength that they keep to themselves so that we can feel safe and secure. That's what we're talking about today on All the Best. We're pulling back the curtain and seeing what mums are really doing behind there, so they can take some credit. I'm Samantha Gruff. Our first story is about a particularly traumatic birth, so heads up that it might have some strong themes.
I started feeling pain at 4 PM. I got home at about 5. I called the ambulance at about 6. I was hospital at 6:30, and my baby was delivered at 8 PM. It's like going through a car accident. It's just that kind of vivid brush with death which I'd had, but I also now was responsible for a baby.
My name is Bina Bhattacharya. I'm 31 years old and I'm a filmmaker living here in Sydney. I found out I was pregnant when I was in New Orleans. It was the last night that we were there. We'd gone back for Mardi Gras and I peed on that stick in a hotel in the French Quarter, and that was when I found out. I was overjoyed. I was so excited. I love being pregnant. I don't think I've ever felt so beautiful and so sensual, and like, I loved it. But I just, I was so nervous all the time. I had read about women with who had miscarriages, and I just didn't think I would ever cope if that happened to me. I also was just so anxious, like everything I
remember
ate.
Just being really terrified I was going to have a miscarriage. I remember holding up toilet paper to the light for months, just so terrified of bleeding.
Was scary.
Bit of bleeding, very common for a lot of women.
I was
can
so
be
excited,
very serious.
But I just,
bit
I
of pain,
just,
very common, thinking, can also be very serious. Weird food cravings, weird headaches, like almost every symptom you have could be nothing and everything.
So I was living in London. My husband, Alexander, had a really cool job working at CNN. I was about 7 months pregnant, nervous, but excited. I had a whole plan of what I was going to do. I had read a lot about breastfeeding. I was so excited about it. I had a whole plan of when I was going to take leave and, make curtains. Okay, I'm going to sleep, sorry. I remember taking the tube home and my husband was working the night shift, so I went home and I was alone. And I started to bleed and I was in a lot of pain. And I rang an ambulance and they said, pack a bag. And I was starting to feel very ill by this point. I threw up in the ambulance onto my way to the hospital. I don't know if that was because of motion sickness or because of what was happening inside my body or just because I was so nervous. And I got to hospital and I don't remember the next part of what happened very well, but it was just terrifying. I remember what it feels like to lose a lot of blood. It's very hot and it has a smell. It smells of iron, like an old coin collection or something. I just remember lots of doctors, and I remember my husband and the look on his face. And I felt like I had disappointed him because I was going to have this really horrible traumatic birth. I had a placental abruption, which is when the placenta detaches. I lost about 1.8 litres of blood and I had really super high blood pressure. And it was, it was awful. My baby was delivered. He was 1.45 kilos. The average baby is about 3. And I delivered at 32 weeks. I didn't see my baby for the longest time. Alex saw him first. When I saw him, I thought he looked like a rat. Just didn't look like a human kid at all. But I still remember his eyes. And I remember the doctor actually said, he looks like you, which I thought was kind of really sweet, because he just didn't really look like much at all at that point. He was really skinny. For the longest time, and this is, I think, why I got so depressed after I had a baby, because I didn't really feel like I had had a baby. I had had this thing done to me, or I'd been through this horrible thing.
I think my husband bonded with my son straight away, but I didn't for the longest time. It was the hospital's baby. I got to visit it sometimes. He didn't look like me. You know, didn't have any warm feelings towards him. He was just the symbol of the worst day of my life. That's kind of how I felt for the longest time. My son spent a month in hospital. It's just kind of rooms with bright lights and noises and beeps and babies crying, but they don't sound like your baby, and other babies crying, and hospitals and routine and visiting at the right hours and being told you have to leave because they're about to do their ward rounds and never eating a proper meal. My birth was incredibly traumatic, so I have clinically diagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder, so all the things that you read about, like people who go through wars or accidents, so, you know, intrusive flashback, difficulty sleeping, anxiety, all those kinds of things. That's kind of one phase of it, but the other part of it I had is something that a lot of mothers also have, which is postnatal depression, which is being incredibly overwhelmed and depressed after your baby is born. These issues are really complicated. The PTSD is actually much more straightforward. People understand you go through something really awful and you're like haunted by it and you struggle to have a normal life. The postnatal depression stuff is kind of much more tricky because I think most motherhood is tedious. And I think there's this idea that you just will have this overwhelming love when your baby is born and therefore you won't mind the late nights and you won't mind the sleeplessness, you will just be carried by love. Like you think you fall in love with a person and you often like have sleepless nights and you, all that kind of thing, but you have this amazing source of energy, you have this amazing reservoir of energy. My parents were in Australia, my husband's parents were in Australia. I remember feeling very jealous, like all the other people in the hospital, their parents could come and support them and cook them a meal and do any of that. I didn't have any of that. And then one day I called my mother and I said, you have to come to London because if you don't, you're going to read about me in the paper. And that was that. In about May of 2016, after probably the worst of it was over, I started to write a film, and that started to solve my problems. Really, truly, it did. I just had this sudden surge of energy that I'd never had, and I negotiated with my husband to stay up between 7 p.m. and midnight every night. And in about 5 days, I knocked out a 90-page script, which is now 120 pages and has had a lot of rewrites. It's up to its fifth rewrite, by the way. I just think all the boredom and the tedium and the just like not wanting to talk about my baby and not wanting to talk about motherhood just kind of gave me this enormous burst of energy, and I did something I never thought I'd be able to do. That was kind of the beginning of my transition back into filmmaking. While I was in London, I'd actually applied for this emerging directors program. I put in this application for this program I had no chance of getting into, but I put pen to paper and I did a pitch for Wild Dancers. I thought, I am going to make a film by Eurovision this year, and I'm going to use the pitch I had written for that program that I had applied for. Wild Dancers is a short film about Australia's love affair with the Eurovision Song Contest and the role the contest has played in bringing together the gay and immigrant communities. It's about a young boy who is obsessed with Ruslana in 2004 while he's dealing with his sexuality and unsubtle questions from his family. And it also looks at the life of a Ukrainian-Australian girl who's also struggling with her family because they want to hold on to their culture, and how Eurovision and embracing camp liberates them both.
Thank you very much for submitting Wild Dancers to the Blah Blah Film Festival. We had a record number of entries this year, and sadly, some of the ones we wanted to include weren't things.
We didn't get into festivals for the longest time, and we were starting to think we'd made a really garbage film. And then I just remember I woke up at like 4 a.m, rolled over, checked my phone as you do, and there's this email saying the Kina Film Festival in Manchester has sent you a message, and I look at it and it said, congratulations, we are pleased to inform you that your film Wild Dancers has been officially selected. So yeah, I woke up and I just felt like finally things were going to work out, and it just kind of has built from there. Everything changed in September, and the final count is we've been accepted into 4. So yeah, for me, it was worth every sacrifice. It's been grueling, but it's also been really fun. All the loneliness and the isolation and the kind of boredom that came with having a baby actually freed me up to do what I was passionate about. And I had the drive to do it as well. The only thing really stopping you is you. You'll never know unless you try. Even if you try and fail, at least you won't be on your deathbed wondering what could have been. You know, you gave it an honest go. So I arrived back to Australia after 2 years in London, where I'd had my son, in
It's end of October 2016. So a year ago.
Wait for me, Dad.
He's just so totally my kid. Like, everything I whinge about is he's incredibly naughty. He's very mischievous.
Don't want
to read? He is very smart. He gets away with what he can. He reads the situation very well. He's just totally my child. Like, all his, even down to his bad behavior. I do think that one day I will write my way back to the pain I endured on September 3rd, 2015, and I'll work through it. But until then, actually, the films I've made, I've kind of been an escape from that, and that's okay too.
That story was by Martin Reyes, with help from supervising producer Britta Jorgensen. Often, the hardest parts of being a mum don't end once the birth is over. This next piece by Marion Wolfe is called Love and Endurance.
So it's 1 a.m. in the morning and I've had a problem with Charlie's latest line change. Huge knot in my stomach that I always get, which is purely stress related, and having to monitor him every hour.
This is my friend, Tori. She and her husband, Mike, have 3 children, Lily, Charlie and Ruby. When Charlie was just 2 years old, he was given a diagnosis.
I tell you, I will never complain about sitting in a waiting room at emergency ever again, because we were shunted all the way right through, bells and whistles going, alarm, alarm, alert, this child is in dire straits. And then, yeah, we were straight into it and they were trying to get sort of IV lines into Charlie. He was screaming and all I could hear was the words, his body's shutting down, and he had hours to live and he wouldn't have made it through the night had we not taken him to hospital.
Hello, my name's Charlie. I'm 13 years old.
So type 1 diabetes is a chronic illness. The pancreas is dead. It doesn't produce insulin. And without injecting insulin, the type 1 diabetes sufferer will not survive.
I wish they knew that type 1 and type 2 are very different, because I hear a lot of jokes that they're the same thing. Like, everyone, they're saying everyone with diabetes is fat, or did you get diabetes because you ate too many lollies and stuff like that.
Type 2 diabetes, your body still produces insulin, it just doesn't process it and absorb it properly. So generally, type 2 diabetics will take an oral tablet, which is designed to help the body absorb the insulin.
Having type 1 diabetes means that Charlie's blood sugar can fluctuate wildly between highs and lows. This means that Tori and Charlie have to measure his sugar levels multiple times a day.
To feel high, it's kind of like you don't have much energy and you're really thirsty and tired and you just don't want to do anything. And feeling low, it feels like you've got no energy and you just want to eat and lie down and just sleep.
The first thing I do when I get up is I go in and I wake him up, and I honestly, I still, you know, take a deep breath every single day. Please, you know, be breathing. Please be breathing. Because there are, you do read horrible cases of people that haven't survived the night because they've had a massive low and been asleep and not realised and stuff. So I still have that lump in my throat every morning.
How was school?
Okay, I had a bad low just before lunch. My hands were shaking.
What were you? What numbers?
3.6, but I felt a lot worse. I had a juice.
Okay. You came up okay?
Yeah.
Okay, well done.
We have had 2 instances of Charlie having severe lows overnight, and I guess in a sense lucky for us, instead of him going unconscious, he's had a very loud diabetic seizure and he's been fitting and screaming and has absolutely no recollection of it. And so twice I've had to give him the big glucagon injection and basically save his life.
Not the best night, was it? See what you are now.
could do with some more sleep, could you?
Yep.
Let's see. Okay, that's good. Perfect.
I get really sick and tired of having to count my carbs and enter it into my pump every time I eat or drink something, and I can never stop thinking about diabetes, and I often get angry at diabetes, and if I do, I'll do something to take my mind off it for a while and calm me down, and it's really hard sometimes because I wish I didn't have it.
You can go along for weeks and months without too many issues, but this week, well, Monday night particularly, was quite challenging. I was up pretty much all night testing him every half an hour, every hour. Thankfully not waking him too much, which was my aim because I really wanted him to sleep. But I just couldn't get him back to normal levels quickly, which was really concerning me. So finally got him to some normal levels around about 5, 6 a.m. in the morning. We were both really tired, very tired on Tuesday actually. It was a little glitch really. I can't explain it. And that's the trouble with diabetes, because sometimes there is no explanation.
When I am overwhelmed by the daily grind that is sometimes the reality of parenting, I think of Tori. How with chronic illness, the mundanity of daily routines coexist terrifyingly close to drama. How you can never rest, never let things slip just this once. How the responsibility and parenting guilt must be amplified. And this is every day, every night, every month, every year, forever. I wonder how anyone exists on such separate planes simultaneously.
It's tiring. It's exhausting, actually. You never stop thinking about it, even when he's not around, even when he's at school. I still worry about him and what his levels are, and has he done his pump, and, you know, has he tested before sport? Has he tested after sport? You know, has he had any lows today? I still think about that all the time. It's mentally really, really tough. It really is. It's one of those diseases that, and which is another bugbear of mine, when people say to you, oh, well, don't worry, it's manageable. Well, they don't realise what it takes to maintain it and what it takes to be manageable. And the minute it's not manageable, it can be terminal. So, yeah, it's full on. It's 24/7, it's full on.
I hate doing it, you know that.
But it's much better to have it, isn't it?
Mm. Is it?
Yes, it is. Less finger pricks, better readings, switches off when it's low, when you're low rather.
I'm pretty sure we have an away game tomorrow.
Okay, well then it's even a better reason to put it on. I'll be as quick can be.
Did you know?
Yep, I can see it, it's there. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Done. Well done. Diabetes burnout is real. When the burdens of this disease become too much, you cry, get angry. You're tired and you don't want to think about it anymore. Diabetes is a 24/7 disease. It never sleeps, it never gives up, neither can we. Coping with this disease means constant worry and stress. Have you done a finger prick test? What was the result? Are you high? Are you low? What action should we take? Have you done your pump? Do you feel okay? Have you eaten enough? How many carbohydrates are you having? Have you done your pump? How much insulin to give? Did we test before, during and after sport?
I hope there's more technology to help with it and help manage it. And I hope that one day there's a cure for it.
It's been a long day without you, my friend.
I'm not going to let this beat us. I'm not going to let diabetes win. It's just not going to happen. So Charlie is my motivation. He's the one going through all this. I'm just merely someone on the side trying to help him out. But he's the one that deals with this all the time.
Charlie's favourite song, See You Again by Wiz Khalifa, took us out of that story by Marion Wolfe. Alison Chan and Beck Fari were supervising producers. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Groth. Late nights, hard births, and balancing the rest of your life are just a few of the challenges that come with being a new mum. It's a bit easier with the support of a partner, especially when you can take turns. Nat is from Sydney, but now lives in California with her partner, Kim. Beth Gibson produced this one.
Kim and I, when we first met, we were really young. We were only 19, 20 years old when we started dating. And at the time, it wasn't so easy to be out. And it wasn't also so accepted by general society at large.
You know, probably from the very beginning of our relationship, I was saying, I want to have kids. And she was saying, like, no, I don't want to. Not now, maybe later.
In particular, I think my family, being European, were fairly conservative socially in that regard. And so they had a really hard time wrapping their minds, especially my parents, around me coming out. So I think that really colored a lot of my thoughts around having kids for a long time.
I mean, I was gonna have kids, and it was just never, ever a question that it wouldn't happen.
Kim's family is American, and they are very liberal. Her parents were kind of beatniks during the 50s, and it's just a very different upbringing and background to mine.
Not everybody should be a parent, not everybody wants to be a parent, but for those people who really do want to be parents, it quite often comes in the form of a really compelling need.
As we got a little bit older, we weren't, you know, 20, 21, 22 anymore. Things were also changing socially and culturally. It was a lot easier to be out. So it was about 10 years in when I felt much more comfortable.
We did something that, you know, I would not recommend and I don't recommend, but it was 22 years ago. We did a home insemination. So we had a friend who is a medical doctor and her wife was a nurse, and they came over and they did the insemination at home. The sperm was from a sperm bank, so it was okay. I mean, in terms of the legality of sperm donation, but technically speaking, it's just safer, better to do it not at home. But we weren't in that mindset then, so we did a home insemination with the one that worked. All the ones that didn't work were done in the doctor's office. The first one we did at home worked. I was at my in-law's house for dinner, Natalie's parents, and actually I wasn't due for about 3 weeks, but I had a really strong sense that I was just done, I was ready, she was ready. She was supposed to be due the first week of May, and I really didn't want to have a baby the first week of May. I didn't want a Taurus. I know that's really terrible, but I just didn't want a Taurus. And then I went into labor. I mean, I started having contractions. It wasn't like in the movies where, you know, there was yelling and screaming and hot towels, and like, it wasn't like that. Nobody was in a panic. There was no one rushing. It was very quiet and very peaceful. So if we went in the hospital at 7:30 and she was born at 2 a.m. So, you know, that's just not very many hours. Abby was born, really interesting. She was born on April 7th at 2 a.m., but it was daylight savings time. So at 2 a.m. she was born, and at like 2:01, all the clocks in the hospital were manually pushed an hour up. So when she was a minute old, she was an hour old, and it's very prophetic of who she is, because she's a very wise, very much wise beyond her years type of person. It was the absolute best moment of my life. Yeah, it was. And it was, you know, It's really amazing because even though you're just meeting the baby for the first time, the moment that you lay eyes on them, it's like kind of like you've just known them your whole life. The moment our eyes locked, it was for both of us like, this is the moment we've both been waiting for our whole lives, and
there's really not really words for it. It's just an amazing experience that this is a human being that you've created and that you're holding.
The familiarity is what's surreal, because where does it come from?
It was somewhat spontaneous. I mean, I was obviously with Kim throughout her whole pregnancy, and I really got to see how much pleasure and joy she got out of being pregnant. I mean, I was very hands-on and involved throughout the whole pregnancy, and then obviously at the birth and the delivery and all of that. So I got really excited about the possibility of being pregnant.
When we were deciding to have a second one, we were actually full steam ahead on me getting pregnant again. Right before we were gonna start, Natalie just sort of offhandedly said, I think I might want to be pregnant.
I never had felt like, oh, I have to be pregnant, but it seemed like such an amazing experience. I think I would like to try it.
Having loved it so much, I knew that I couldn't deprive her of having that experience. So we changed gears, and instead of me getting pregnant, she got pregnant the second time. We used the same sperm donor and the same nurse and doctor friend. It was pretty funny because when we did the first insemination, we had no kids and they had no kids. And so it was like, you know, candlelight and wine and trying to make it nice and special. But when they came to do the second insemination, Abby was 2 years old, our daughter, and they had a son who was one. So we had like kids in the other room watching Sesame Street videos, you know. It was very, very different atmosphere.
What I had was a C-section, and we did it on the early side because our daughter was breech, completely breech. So she had her head up and her hips down. They did an ultrasound and they saw that there really wasn't enough fluid left in the amniotic sac to like be able to allow her to turn. So they decided that because the fluid levels were dropping and she wasn't going to turn, that it was probably a safe call to do a C-section. And with the C-section, it's pretty quick. I mean, they give you an epidural, and then as soon as you're numb, they pretty much open you up and take the baby out and then stitch you back up again. So it's not a long process. It's an odd feeling somebody rummaging around inside your abdomen and knowing there's no pain because you're numbed out, but thinking, oh, this is going to hurt later. And then they just lifted Jenna out. Our doctor, Connie, hooked her fingers under Jenna's hips and then lifted her up with her little butt up in the air, and it was very cute. And that was actually how we found out she was a girl too. The one thing that was really hilarious with her was that because she was breech, her legs were straight. So anytime you unwrapped her or unswaddled her, her feet would like stick straight up out, like everything just fully extended. It was pretty cute.
You know, it didn't feel like I was on the other side watching it. For both Natalie and I, even though I was pregnant the first time and Natalie was pregnant the second time, we both related to both pregnancies like my pregnancy was our first pregnancy and her pregnancy was our second pregnancy.
At one point, my obstetrician joked with me while I was pregnant. She's like, you don't act like a woman who's pregnant for the first time. You act like somebody who's been pregnant before.
It didn't feel like this was mine and that one, that was her pregnancy. It really felt like very much a shared experience. The timing of this interview is pretty funny because we've only been home now 3 days from moving our younger daughter into college. So both of our girls are in college now and we are empty nesters as of 3 days ago.
Yeah, it's bittersweet. Actually, before my younger daughter just left to start university, we pulled out old family movies and put them up and were watching her and her sister when they were really tiny.
And it is very weird. We're in the house alone without the kids. And
it does feel in the beginning like every stage is quite slow, but then sort of time has this way of picking up pace.
I think a lot about all the years we had together and, you know, the best time in my life. But I haven't thought about her birth in a long time. But it was singularly the best moment of my life.
Our Sim production manager, Beth Gibson, produced that story with help from Marit Polak. If you like their work, you can check out their podcast. It's called Private Parts. It's one of our faves, and you can find it at partlyprivate.com. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with 3RRR and SYN in Melbourne. Our executive producers are Selena Shannon and Beck Fari. Our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN production manager. Tegan Nichols compiles the show, and I'm your host, Samantha Groth. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter, and every single one of our previous episodes is patiently waiting for you at allthebestradio.com. We'd love you to subscribe to All the Best on your favourite podcast app. And hey, maybe your mum would like it too, so share it around.